If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 135 is something like, how are our basic metaphysical concepts like being, nothingness, becoming, quality, and quantity related? And we're continuing last episode's discussion by reading more of G.F.W. Hegel's Logic, in this case, the Encyclopedia Logic or Lesser Logic, sections 79 to 99. That's from 1817. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, being here in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Allwyn, penetrating deeper and deeper into the excitation that underlies the false surface called being in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, transitioning to a determinant being as such in Middleton, Wisconsin.
This is Amog Sahu, being for self in Toronto, Canada.
Wonderful. All right, we tried to dive in to see if this actually works. So the beginning of the sections that we read were really pointing out the difference between the right kind of abstraction and the wrong kind of abstraction. It seems like logic is super abstract, but he talks about the difference really between the understanding and reason, taken more or less in Kant's sense as two different faculties, where if you're simply thinking about something in the abstract, like I'm just thinking about its shape and not thinking about anything else, and then you mistakenly think that you can draw grand conclusions from that, then that's an abuse of the understanding. You're not really doing philosophy. That even an abstraction like a number can't just be considered like abstracting from a particular instance of, you know,
What are you talking about?
I'm just trying to give an introduction, and as usual, it's spilling out, so I won't even try to keep going. Anyway, there's a good way and a bad way. And then the second part of what we read had to do with actually getting going on the logic, which starts with being and analyzes being in terms of, if you look closely, that being is the same thing as nothing, and then being and nothing are both sublated into becoming. And we continue a few more stages along that through determinant being, which is quality, and then to quantity. And that's where we stopped. So that was my high-level summary.
We could remind the listeners what's motivating all this. When we talk about logic here, we're talking about something closer to what we would call ontology and Hegel's version of a derivation of what in Kant and Aristotle are called categories. So these are sort of logical categories, but really they're basic different ways things can be. So that includes things like quantity and also things like quality, which we'll discuss what that means. But the last time we saw that, he has some pretty typical objections to Kant. One of them is that the Kantian system, by divorcing logical form and the content of things, right? So Kant has these categories applied by the understanding, but the data that comes in to be shaped by those categories comes from some sort of outside and we don't know where it is. And then the form is sort of cookie cutter impressed on that. And in the end, we're left with this thing in itself that's outside of experience that we're out of contact with. So Hegel is going to give us a derivation of the categories that isn't so hostile to things in themselves and will put us back in touch with reality, so to speak.
And truth, right? So that you won't have the distinction between the way in which we think of as conventional logic, what he would call conventional logic, as providing you the rules for thinking, but which you sort of throw up your hands at whether or not it's actually true or not, because that all depends upon the truth of the predicates.
Two notions of truth seem to be operating here, actually. I mean, one notion of truth is the one we get from formal logic, which is, here's a proposition, is it true or false? And that sense of truth is something Hegel talks about a bit, but there's another sense of truth, which is grasping the world in a certain sense, right? Where the categories of thought match up with the categories of being, i.e., we have a perfectly intelligible account of all that is. That's the sense of truth that I think is really important here.
He basically spits on the first one. Even if he acknowledges that it exists, he just thinks it's just such a low bar that at the very best, you would say that was part of the past progress of philosophical thought. We should graduate from that.
You could have a sentence that's true, but it's not the whole truth.
Right. It's incomplete would be the right way to say it.
The level of disdain he has for that level of incompleteness is profound.
The two senses of truth, as far as I can tell, are the Kantian sense, quote-unquote truth, which has to do with appearances, and then the truth of what we would call things in themselves.
How would you match that up with the distinction between the truth of a syllogism in its form versus real truth? Or do you think that that's just another aspect of the same distinction?
You seem to be talking about the difference between what we typically think of as logical form and the way in which we get valid inferences. I'm not sure about that.
Well, he talked about that at the beginning in our first reading quite a bit about that, yeah. And tracing it back to Aristotle and Plato and the entire history of philosophy, and tied it, in fact, to coming to a head in some ways in someone like Kant. I would buy the argument that they're peas in a pod of the same problem.
At the end of page 287 on the Hackett, there is actually just a contrast of these two notions of truth in this little aside. Truth is understood first to mean that I know how something is. But this is truth only in relation to consciousness. It is formal truth, mere correctness. In contrast with this, truth in the deeper sense means that objectivity is identical with the concept. It is this deeper sense of truth which is at issue when we speak, for instance, of a true state or a true work of art. These objects are true when they are what they ought to be, when their reality corresponds to their concept.
Right. So we're trying to get at, just like back in Plato, that he would say, no, don't just tell me examples of justice. I want to know what justice is. That metaphysical truths are getting at the concept with a capital C.
Right. There's various ways to render this. Not exactly clear what it is. My kind of working idea is our intelligible understanding of things, something like that. Once our intelligible understanding of things gets into touch with the things themselves, that kind of illumination is, I think, what truth, in the real truth that we're talking about, means.
Yes, and the way you put that makes clear as we go, and this is, again, mostly reviewing last time, it would have been much clearer to me why in Frege's paper, the thought that we had to think, why, but a thought for Frege isn't something in somebody's head, it's something objective, it's something in the world. Well, he was using that usage that, I don't know if it was invented by Hegel, but it's all over here. That when you're talking about these deeper metaphysical truths and talking them about as intelligibility, it's all about these objectively existing truths, thoughts. It's not just a state of affairs of things in the world. It's more abstract than that. That, in fact, we're talking here about being abstractly is where we start the whole investigation. And if you think about that as, oh, well, this chair has being. No, you're not thinking abstractly anymore. You're thinking about the concrete chair. We're trying to get at the logical truth, the conceptual truth of being. That is a thought. And it is a thought, whether or not you are thinking it or I am thinking it, it is something that is objective about the world, not about the physical world. It's more abstract than that, but it's objectively about the world. It is available to all times and cultures. Anybody that's smart enough to figure it out, to do real philosophy.
The thought in question here is not a thought that's in someone's head necessarily. It is the underlying thought structure of the world in itself.
Hegel talks about these things like shapes of consciousness, which are not like individual things. They're like worldviews, like sense certainty and perception and so on. Same thing with being here. It's not like a single concept like dog. It's like a way of viewing the whole world. Everything is. That may illuminate to some extent what concept, capital C, is a bit like.
So concept with a capital C, I associate that as well with God. Am I right to do that? Or
I suppose when the concept's been brought to completion in the idea, then it becomes God at the end of the logic.
We'll have to see. He brings up God throughout this. And I know I said in the last episode that, well, you can't really tell, despite him bringing all this, what his theological views are. I kind of changed my mind going through the lecture note part of this. So this is, again, the encyclopedia, which is the dumbed down version. And what's more, it's the dumbed down version of the logic, but it has these insertions of apparently lecture notes about these points. Plus, for almost every section in here, there's places where it says addition, where something was added in the later edition of the text. And there were at least two additions. It's basically commentary upon commentary to further try to clarify these points.
Right.
For concept and idea, what's the difference in the German?
Concept, I think, is, I mean, I'm again, referring to the phenomenology a bit.
Begriff.
Notion is what people read back there. Begriff, yeah.
Well, the notion is the Vorstellung. The notion is not as good.
Oh, right. There's a similar usage. It's not really important for our understanding here. But the idea in Kant is something like the ideas of reason, like God, right? Capital I ideas.
And what is the German, though, for that? Is it just Idee?
Yes, yeah. I think so. So it's not like one misleading use of the term idea, something like Lockean ideas, which is like individual thoughts of the mind of things. That's not what this is at all. It's something like the ideal. Ideal conveys some of the sense of perfection and completion, which seems to be implied here.
Okay, so shall we...
Yeah, let's dive in. We got a lot right at the beginning here, section 79, about what the dialectic actually is. And we tried to do that in the second half of our last discussion. Section 79, with regard to its form, the logical has three sides. First, the side of abstraction or of the understanding. Second, the dialectical or negatively rational side. And third, the speculative or positively rational one. So that's as close as he comes to thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And talks about while about what you start with, which is an abstraction of the understanding, which I was saying is there's something bad about that. Well, it's bad in that it's incomplete.
Yeah, let's talk about what the understanding does. And he's going to talk a lot about the sense in which it gives us what he calls fixed determinacies. So that's in section 80A. It stops short at the fixed determinacy, which, Mark, as you mentioned, is a defect in a way, but it's the talent of the understanding. It's the good thing about it. So what does it mean to have a fixed determinacy?
The way I understand it is very much like a single rigid conceptual form which you impose on an object. And you made a determinate, right? You've given it a certain content. You've called all these impressions dog, but it acts like a sort of delimiting cage where it has certain conditions of application and you put it in certain propositions like this is a dog, dogs are whatever. But it's inert in a certain sense because it's this name which rigidly applies to certain things and it doesn't change in any way.
We can think here of what Kant called the manifold or just this sort of buzzing confusion before it's been shaped by the concepts of the understanding. The strange thing about this is that in order to...
The notions of the understanding. Which is
sure. What we would call concepts.
Yes. Small c. Yep.
Right.
So the interesting thing here is that in order to have an experience, even of a particular thing, like a dog, I don't think it's a bad example, we have to have this universalizing moment. We have to be able to subsume that particular under a universal. And until we've done that, it can't even be this particular thing that we're having an experience of. So the positive side of that is just that it does what he says. It determines things. It actually makes it not just this big mass of gobbledygook, but these specific things. But on the other hand, it abstracts. It sort of carries some of the defect of what it's trying to solve forward.
Is it both those steps? Is it that you break the world up into thises and thats, and also some of the thises are like those thats, so that you would not just have distinction, so you pick out individual objects, but you'd also, in addition at this stage, say, that's a tree, and that's also a tree, and that's also a tree, and that's a dog, and that's also a dog. At that point, you use the character of likeness to establish, I don't know if it's a concept or a notion.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. Even for the tree to sort of emerge from the landscape, even for it to be a distinct thing and not buried within the forest, let's say. We have to have made those comparisons, like you said. There has to be a point of comparison to other things before it even becomes articulated out of its background.
There wouldn't be, prior to that, just the mere making of distinctions without the thought of what they were like yet?
There is, but he's just talking in general about what the understanding as a faculty does. And the understanding would not be satisfied with just this is and that, right?
The understanding is doing both those things because being has no distinction, right?
Being is the kind of thing that the understanding can't get a handle on because it is too high level. It is too general.
Yes.
The understanding is always only one step removed from a concrete particular, I guess.
So with understanding, we have the world broken into pieces and, in fact, a kind of manifold on top of it.
Well,
and
it organizes the manifold, yeah.
Right now, we've immediately walked into embeddedness, right? I mean, that's the way we talk about it now. We'd say the only way you have understanding right out from the gate is that you have a manifold that you lay on top of the world. It doesn't emerge out of the world at all. You characterize dogs and cats and trees and stuff like that. And even if it's through the activity of likeness, it's not emerging out of the world. At best, it's emerging out of you.
I just think this is going way beyond what his description of the understanding is here.
Well, I'm just trying to understand his understanding.
So let's read some more quotes here. This is in part of 80, one of the first edition. The activity of the understanding consists generally in the bestowing of the form of universality on its content. And the universal posited by the understanding is, of course, an abstract one, which is held onto in firm opposition to the particular. But as a result, it is itself determined also as a particular again. So I'm thinking of the way that people that are new to philosophy, they'll say, before we start, we have to define our terms. In other words, we have to fix all of the universals in a very static way. And you might even think that's the whole goal of philosophy. If you're Ayn Rand, you think, you know, she thinks she's just being Aristotle, but that's the whole goal. It's just to come up with adequate definitions for everything. And they're static and they will enable you to do practical reasoning and determine what can be determined about the theoretical. Hegel wants to argue that this is misguided. It is incomplete, is not philosophy.
Well, but it's the basis of everyday experience and to some extent science. And
practical reason and everything like that. But the phrase used in like contemporary metaphysical talk is like carving the world up is something that you think about. The point is that carving the world up involves doing all the things that you guys have been talking about in terms of putting things into classes, talking about matters and kinds and so on and so forth. But also the temptation is to kind of close your conceptual system that you've constructed there, to say that all of these kinds or types hang together in some way by the systematic unity of reason. I think it's the Kant phrase. And his point is that the understanding naturally has this tendency to cut things up in this way and through the cutting up freeze the world, where your way of cutting things up is fixed and unchangeable because you've made things, you've closed the world in a certain sense.
What Mark is trying to point out is so if you look at the next paragraph, the common complaint against the understanding or thinking is that it, well, he says, quote unquote, leads to ruinous and destructive results, which is by cutting up the whole, a world which is at bottom a whole has to get cut up. And it's inadequate, as Kant pointed out, it's inadequate to grasping things in themselves and, let's see, the objects of metaphysics and God and soul and all those sorts of things. But you know, here right out, Hegel's going to say, well, not to rational thinking, but only to understanding. Are those things inaccessible? And his whole departure from Kant is, for Kant, you couldn't know those things. You might think about them. They might be objects of reason in a sense. But for Hegel, rational thinking is actually going to be a faculty of knowledge and not just understanding. So he's going to let us out of that cage.
Just to give an idea of one of these ruinous consequences, just a point that he makes right at the end of the reading that we did was basically against scientism, which is you could abstract from the things we observe to quantity and say quantity is where it's all at, and then kind of equate knowledge with quantity, and anything that can't be quantified, you can't have firm knowledge about. And that leads to emphasis on physics as being the ideal science and neglect of things like politics or anything else that's more fuzzy.
The passages about pointing out the metaphysics in physics I particularly liked. It's very relevant.
The paragraph after one I just read, because I just want to get at this tension that we already brought out, is that, hey, there are benefits to the understanding. It's not just all bad. Without the understanding, there is no fixity or determinacy in the domains either of theory or practice, and so on and so forth.
It's the starting point for the dialectic, for sure. It's the first stage.
He has his big philosophical goal. In daily life, it has its applications. In science, it has its applications. So, for instance, thus, in consideration of nature, for example, distinctions are drawn between matters, forces, kinds, etc., and they are marked off, each on its own account, in isolation from one another. In doing all this, thinking functions as understanding, and its principle here is identity, simple self-relation. I sort of segued us into another topic there. It has its utility, you know, when you want to mark things off from each other, in many cases we do, that's what the understanding is for. You couldn't have what we call experiences without the understanding. I think he agrees with Kant on that. And then this reference to identity and simple self-relation is this idea that the impetus behind all of this is this sort of drive in us that compares everything or causally connects everything, this drive to unify everything which is sort of, for Kant, is the basis of the application of these categories. The categories are simply articulations of that unifying drive.
Right. There's a wonderful passage here about the use of understanding in practical reason. Understanding allows us, we have to focus in a certain sense and not drag ourselves off in all different directions.
Yeah, he repeatedly harps on that, actually. I noticed that there are two places in here where he uses the idea of not spreading yourself too thin. But yeah, go ahead and point out this first one, because I think these are great.
Understanding is just as indispensable in the practical sphere as it is in that of theory. Character is an essential factor in conduct, and a man of character is a man of understanding, who, for that reason, has definite purposes in mind and pursues them with firm intent. As Goethe says, someone who wants to do great things must know how to restrict himself. In contrast, someone who wants to do everything really wants to do nothing and brings nothing off. I really like that.
Let's see, later on, he says, human beings who want to be actual must be there, and to this end, they must limit themselves. So it's a more indirect statement of the same thing. So there's at least two examples in our reading, and I'm sure there's more in his corpus, that it's a sort of a preoccupation, which is ironic given the fact that he's such a polymath himself.
It's very proto-existentialist.
Yes, necessity of finitude and having boundaries. And, you know, we could speak to that in psychology as well across a whole bunch of different domains.
You would only have to say that because it's sort of an ontological option for us at all time to not do this, to dive into nothingness, to follow, to eschew the directions of the understanding and get spread out in this way.
To be the dilettante.
Right. It's profound advice to an undergraduate.
Or to someone my age.
Right.
As well.
I'm told this problem recurs.
So keeping, I thought this still in the same section, another sort of practical application. The understanding must be regarded as corresponding to what people call the goodness of God, where this is understood to mean that finite things are, that they subsist. For instance, we recognize the goodness of God in nature by the fact that the various kinds and classes of both animal and plants are provided with everything they need in order to preserve themselves and prosper. In other words, the understanding picks up on these teleological patterns. And so it's a perfectly adequate application of the understanding to pick up the banana and say, look how well the banana is shaped for us to eat it. It's like it has a handle, that kind of horrible. But it's only when you take that, again, when you take that actually that you're making a metaphysical claim, you have to realize that these abstractions of the understanding are just that, are very one-sided abstractions, and they don't actually convey metaphysical truth in themselves.
Well, remember Kant in the Critique of Judgment, one of the basic characterizations of understanding, in a sense that it's a faculty of judgment, is this finding out that things seem to be arranged as if they are suited to the understanding, that is, it's suited to the project of being understood. So that's the broader level, but there's this more specific teleology as well, where we notice that things have final ends, basically.
So this is his only place, since you're bringing up the third critique, there are aesthetic stuff. Hegel actually talks about art here just in the next paragraph. In art, for example, the understanding manifests itself in the fact that the forms of the beautiful, which are conceptually diverse, are maintained in their conceptual distinctness and are presented distinctly. That's not very informative.
There's a difference between just slopping a whole bunch of paint on the canvas and having articulated forms, right? You can't have aesthetics unless you have these distinct articulated forms. Otherwise, it's just all...
Yeah, he elaborates this a little more. It is a feature of beauty and perfection of a dramatic work, therefore, that the characters and the various persons should be sustained in their purity and determinacy, and similarly, that the various purposes and interests that are involved should be presented clearly and decisively. Which I think we saw that, yes, in both Kant and Schopenhauer in their takes on art, that they would not be down with Impressionism.
Well, now, I mean, he's talking, I think, about literature. Yeah, dramatic work. That applies specifically to dramatic work, that idea of...
Well, Impressionism or its equivalent in the various, you want distinct forms in
so
all
that,
types
yeah,
of art.
That could be a nicely painted scene by Vermeer, very precise, or it could be, let's say, a Dickensian delving into character where you get something that's really well articulated as opposed to a stereotype or a cardboard cutout, that sort of difference.
He also does this with religion.
So how does he do it with religion? Yeah.
The determinacy is again a virtue. As to what follows next, the domain of religion, the superiority of Greek over Nordic mythology, for instance, essentially consists, apart from any further diversity of content and interpretation, in the former, each figure of the gods is developed into a sculptural determinacy, whilst in the latter, they flow into one another in a fog of murky indeterminacy. So the idea that, like, some mythologies are richer than others seems right.
There's a much more precise division of labor in Greek mythology than in Norse mythology.
Because they all just fight in Norse mythology, except for Loki the trickster. Everybody else is just fighting.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of mythology in my youth and read things in both of those and did not note that in particular. It seemed that the visions of Baldur and Odin and Thor were plenty clear.
Well, he's wrong, man.
Yeah. You didn't see the innate superiority of the determinacy of Greek.
Yes, I was not looking for archetypes corresponding to natural functions or something, whatever.
Well, that's right. Just a sign that it wasn't true.
Yeah, I suppose that Odin and Thor have something to do with the weather, not just one of them has something to do with the weather. All right, well, we don't have to talk about mythology anymore. In fact, instead, I want to stop for a minute and talk about our sponsors. First, we are sponsored by The Great Courses, who come back to us time and again for advertising because the people who like this podcast are the people who like them, are lifelong learners who like to get interesting stuff sent to them over the internet, which is why we're excited to tell you about The Great Courses' new video learning service, The Great Courses Plus, which gives you unlimited access to a huge library of lecture series in so many topics, including philosophy, history, music, mindfulness, so much more, taught by top professors. We very much want you to try The Great Courses Plus, and we've got a deal for our listeners, a special chance to watch their popular course, The Great Ideas of Philosophy, and hundreds of other courses, absolutely free. Now, this is one we've talked about before. It's taught by Professor Daniel Robinson, and it actually involves 60 half-hour lectures, filling in lots of the gaps that we've left in this podcast. So you can hear about things like Aristotle on friendship, on the Stoic bridge to Christianity, on Islam, on the Renaissance, on Darwinism. He goes through history for 49 lectures and then tackles topics, the philosophy of science, philosophy of mind, psychology, ontology, law, just war theory, aesthetics, ethics, and finally God. Now, I've just now been watching lecture 39, The Hegelians and History, which really gives a nice overview of Hegel's project, how it fits in with his contemporaries. I didn't really understand the relationship before between Hegel and Romanticism, which I'm not going to try to explain here, but I will give you one clarifying point exactly relevant to the discussion of the logic we've been having, which is just this particular formulation that according to Hegel, the mind knows itself not as appearance, but in reality. It knows itself noumenally. So if you're wondering how can Hegel get past appearances to the thing in itself, exactly the thing that Kant thought you could not do, well, that's what the logic is about. The deep structures of thought are one and the same of the deep structures of reality. Being is a concept, is a thought, not in my mind or your mind, but in the structure of the universe, and individual entities partake of that being. Now, obviously, I could go on and on, and that's the point. These courses are thought-provoking, and while obviously we podcasters love the back and forth and really ambiguity in what we do in doing philosophy on the fly, I think supplementing that with lectures taught by professionals who have been doing this for many, many years is very advisable. With The Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere. You can stream from any internet-connected TV, computer, or through The Great Courses Plus apps. And again, The Great Courses Plus is offering you a chance to stream hundreds of their courses, including The Great Ideas of Philosophy, a $530 value just for that, for free when you use our special URL. So go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus, P-L-U-S, spell it out, .com/PEL.
Hey folks, it's Seth. It is South by Southwest time in Austin, Texas, and I am planning on braving the crowds and hobnobbing with hipsters to listen to some great music and occasionally see a film or two. And before I do so, let me tell you, I want to be clean shaven. Now, I've been using the Blades face wash and aftershave that Harry's sent over, and I've been getting the best shave and have the nicest, softest, most relaxed skin as I've had in a long time. Now, I'm going to encourage you to give Harry's a shot because they have these amazing German-engineered blades that are super high quality. They give you a close shave with no cuts or burns, and they guarantee the quality. They will give you a full refund if you're not happy. Now, Harry's model is they send the products directly to you. They cut out the middleman. It comes straight to your door. And that's why their prices are so awesome. And because it comes to the door, that means you do not have to go shopping. You do not have to deal with the nonsense at the supermarkets where the highly expensive blades are locked up in a case and the alarm goes off every time you try to get them. You can order what you need and check out in 30 seconds at harrys.com. Harry's offers customized shave plans that makes it easy for you to get these awesome shaving supplies delivered directly to your door on your terms based on how often you shave. Harry's is so confident that you'll love your shave. For a limited time, they are offering to let you try it for free when you sign up for a shave plan. Get one of Harry's beautifully crafted razor handles with a 5-blade cartridge, engineered in Germany, their foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for free. Just cover the $3 shipping charge. Go to harrys.com/PEL right now to start your free trial. That's harrys.com/PEL.
Hey, everybody. Brian Wilson here to talk a little bit about what's going on with the Partially Examined Life's Not School program. We've expanded our offerings in the intro readings and philosophy group, which I'll be leading. We've got Plato's Crito coming up on March 20th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be following this up with 3 more readings that are scheduled once a month: Aristotle's Ethics, Descartes' Meditations Concerning First Philosophy, Michel de Montaigne's Of Cannibals, and Of the Education of Children. Check out the Not School program's Intro Readings and Philosophy section for more info. Also on the Not School forums, Nietzsche is so hot right now. Justin Madra has a group forming to take a stab at Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and Michael Murray is hammering down dates to tackle Nietzsche's Death of God. Keegan Venzemirin will be leading a seminar on Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan on March 19th as well. To register for any of these seminars, you simply have to become a PEL citizen, meaning pay $5 a month, $5 being a crazily low rate to pay for this kind of personal interaction and instruction. And of course, it also includes the full-length, ad-free versions of the entire PEL back catalog. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me at Brian, B-R-I-A-N, at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thanks a lot, and hope to see you soon.
Let's get back to it.
It's hard for me not to think about the criticisms of the thing in itself, just the inability to know the world, which is, you know, all variations of Kant. And here Hegel is just utterly insisting that the world is plain in a certain way, even if it's complicated. It just makes me wonder about, again, the whole issue with error and being wrong. And is it so easy to get past this manifold that we put on the world to absolute knowing, except by fiat, right? There's a way in which even from the beginning, it feels like the answer that he's saying is that, well, we just can. That's just the character of thought. It's not clear to me where the response to even Kant's insistence that it's not possible is there, other than by saying that it is.
I suppose it's not necessarily insistent that the world is comprehensible. I mean, a humble reading of Hegel would be to say that you can't, before the thing has got going, insist that a certain realm is closed to us a priori. So that's, I think, the way in which he wants to talk about it.
I think his insistence on the absolute, that seems like that's by fiat. But throughout here, I take him as presenting the aspectualist option as opposed to the phenomena versus noumena. In other words, aspectualism is just that we see an aspect of reality. So what the understanding is doing here, insofar as it is identifying truths, it is identifying truths that are not the whole truth, but they're still truths. So as long as you're really thinking clearly, then you're getting at things in themselves. It's just what do you want? You're not getting at them in their totality, and you wouldn't expect to on first blush.
This section in particular that we just discussed, so at the top of 127, before we got into this whole goodness of God thing, what's motivating this is this idea. So our early explanations showed that logical thinking in general must not be interpreted merely in terms of a subjective activity, but rather as what is strictly universal and hence objective at the same time. The subjective activity would be the understanding applies its concepts, to use Kant's term, to the experience, and then makes objective, quote-unquote, judgments about the appearances. So that to Hegel, none of that is really true in Hegel's sense. And he wants to give some examples where the understanding, in fact, is involved in objectivity. That's where he starts talking about the goodness of God and teleology, art, religion, and philosophy. And then he comes back to that at the end, where he says that the drawbacks of the understanding at the very last paragraph of section 80, but again, it is usually said also the understanding must not go too far. And that's, he's giving a recapitulation there of Kant's critique of the understanding, which is that the understanding is finite, and more precisely, it is such that when it is pushed to an extreme, it overturns into its opposite. I get intimations that he thinks the understanding has some role in grasping of things in themselves, and that's why we got talk of art and religion, for instance. But he's still holding on to the idea that it will find its way into these contradictions because of its abstracting behavior.
Why, you've moved us to the second section, section 81, the dialectical moment. We started, what was the name of the first moment? Thinking as the side of abstraction or the understanding, and then the dialectical or negatively rational side. So now he's considering the dialectical moment, the moment of self-sublation of these finite determinations on their own part, and they're passing into their opposite. That's hard to talk about, but he immediately clarifies that he's going to talk about skepticism here, that when you take any of these claims, like, hey, look, the banana demonstrates the goodness of God, and you look at it too closely, he actually thinks that none of these things hold up.
Or any challenge to your naive realism, right? So you're walking along, you know, the world is as it seems and so on and so forth. And then Sextus Empiricus comes and says, well, what about the ore and the water? And that's the distorting effect of, you know, all of that skeptical stuff. That's the negation here. We have the fixed determinacies and everything seems great. They perform their functions. And then it doesn't take much to take us to start seeing that there's a lot of problems with that whole picture of the world.
Right. One way of seeing how the skeptic is brought into making these sort of one-sided and abstract determinations is to think about the sort of traditional idea that thought and being are separate, which I think goes back to the Greek skeptics, which is that, hey, we may think a certain way, we may have certain ideas, we may have certain cognitive capacities, but there's something out there which always escapes that. Hegel's point is you're insisting on a rigid separation of these categories, thought, what we think, and being, what there is. The point is you have to demonstrate how categories pass into each other in this way, which he's going to do throughout the logic.
Yeah, that'll be the solution. And that's really, yes, the whole driving force of this dialectic is this underlying assumption of this schism between thought and being, which is obviously present in the skeptics as well. The skeptics are trying to tell us things are not as they seem.
Hegel thinks he can bridge the chasm.
Yeah.
Well, but in the way that he does it is a little, I mean, we'll get into his specific quotes, but we've already anticipated it is, if you say that thought is not something in an individual's head, but is something objectively out there, and then you say that at least some of these kind of thoughts, the most authentically philosophical thoughts, are not about concrete things, but are about these categories themselves, then it becomes very difficult to tell the difference between a thought about being and being itself.
Right.
Right. Thinking is a being. It's kind of a weird way of looking at the world, say with Kant, where you have this, you're talking about subjectivity, but you can't really locate the subject in the world of things in themselves. You can't locate it anywhere because it can't be located in its own field of experience, right? It's the conditions for the possibility of that field. And you can't locate it in the worlds of things in themselves because that's all off limits. So Hegel's going to say, yes, we can locate that. That subjectivity is a being. Well, I mean, ultimately, it's an aspect of the uber subject, let's say, who is united with the object.
What else about this skepticism stuff here?
He talks about Socrates, the dialectic, not being a new thing in philosophy. Dialectic is the direct translation simply argument in time or something like that. Passage is interesting. It's 129. Besides, the dialectic is not a new thing in philosophy. Among the ancients, Plato is called the inventor of the dialectic. That is quite correct in that it is in the Platonic philosophy that dialectic first occurs in a form which is freely scientific and hence also objective. With Socrates, dialectical thinking still has a predominantly subjective shape, consistent with the general character of his philosophizing, namely that of irony. That's really interesting because Kierkegaard wrote his dissertation, may not be the right word, on the concept of irony in Socrates. The enemy of Hegel, as he's sort of christened all the time, you see the dividing lines come up already.
So from what I understand of dialectic in Plato and with Socrates, the way it shows up in Socrates' method is that you sort of question an interlocutor. They're filled with contradictions, you know, with all these opinions that they think are consistent, but they're inherently contradictory. You drive them towards a new conclusion, find a contradiction, then they're driven towards a certain conclusion, and then that's only the beginning, because Socrates is going to then show that that one doesn't work, and then so on and so forth. That's what I see as the dialectical method in Socrates. I understand the element of irony, but what does he mean specifically by it here?
Is it subjective just in that he's dealing with the particular interlocutor and that person's sort of issues, and just mostly trying to shake them of their... Whereas he's distinguishing that from Plato, who actually gets down to what is justice and tries to take from wherever the interlocutor starts to take it through an objective dialectical back and forth of, you know, is justice the will of the strong? No. Is it to get to the objectively correct answer?
I think that's it. I mean, he talks about Socrates being accustomed to pretend in his conversations that he wanted to be instructed more precisely about the matter under discussion.
Right, that's the pretense, yeah.
Right, the idea is, hey, help me out. And Hegel's point is that that kind of Socratic destruction of people's point of view doesn't really seem to get you anywhere, right? It's subjective in the sense that it's just the other side of this fixity of determinations. It's just demonstrating that we carve the world up, you're never going to get to how the world really is like.
I mean, he characterizes Plato saying, Plato employs the dialectic method to show the finitude of all hard and fast terms of understanding. So the dialectical method in Plato's hands is slicing and dicing and rendering all terms of the understanding as finite. And that's going to, in the end, be the bane of Hegel, right? Because it's all going to have to ultimately transition into the unity of finitude and infinity. But at the end of the section that was not part of the notes, he says, by dialectic is meant the indwelling tendency outwards by which the one-sidedness and limitations of the predicates of understanding is seen in its true light and shown to be the negation of them. For anything to be finite is just to suppress itself and put itself aside. Thus understood, the dialectical principle constitutes the life and soul of scientific progress, the dynamic which alone gives immanent connection and necessity to the body of science, and in a word, is seen to constitute the real and true as opposed to the external exaltation above the finite. Yeah, so I think the reason he wants to say that the dialectic is the source, life and soul of scientific progress, and later on it's said that dialectic is the soul of all knowledge, is this rendering of elements of knowledge into finite bits. And that's going to have to be transcended, but that's both its power and its limitation.
Yeah, you get to see their inadequacy. Because they're finite, they're inevitably inadequate. One scientific explanation will be superseded by another eventually.
And so the activity of the dialectic, just in the way you said it, Wes, you see immediately how it's an engine for scientific thinking. But when you start turning it out to its natural conclusion, you run into all kinds of absurdities or things that don't make any sense. And now I'm just sort of extrapolating from Hegel. But Hegel, to me, would say, well, that's just a sign that it's not the end of the road. Dialectic isn't going to get you the answer. It's not the full articulation of thinking in the world, because you end up with these absurdities which need to be transcended.
If you just take dialectic as negative, then you don't appreciate that it's not just a saying what you said is wrong. You started the argument by using the understanding to pick out a generalization, and the second step of the dialectic comes along and doesn't just say no. No, it's a determinant negative. It's not an empty abstract nothing, but the negation of certain determinations which are contained in a result precisely because it is not an immediate nothing, but a result.
Right. You're not in the same place that you were at the beginning.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, what did you learn by the fact that we were able to overcome? You thought that justice was the will of the strong, and I showed you that that didn't make any sense. Where does that push you next? What is your new view of justice? So the third step of the dialectic is the speculative or positively rational, which apprehends the unity of the determinations and their opposition, the affirmative that is contained in their dissolution and in their transition.
This is the spookiest bit of the three, I think. Spooky is generally like a term of abuse in analytic philosophy whenever you don't like something. Generally, the idea of transcendence is less grounded almost by definition than the other stuff. But I mean, it follows from the way he set it out, right? It's like you have this conceptual system. You've criticized it in this way, but the criticism is not really we often think of criticisms as from outside. The criticism is actually the internal logic of the conceptual system in its attempt to grasp reality. It realizes its inadequacy. And through the way it realizes inadequacy, it realizes the next step to which it has to make. And thus it transcends. You can see, even though thesis, antithesis, synthesis, I don't think are the right words to use. I'm already using this word.
He does use the word antithesis a lot, but yeah. But the other is...
Right. I mean, it's, the point is it's a single thing. It was what I was trying to say. It's not like one person, another person, third person is the way, you know, you think about it.
Right, right.
One thing, sure. Another thing, third. Yeah. So it's like you realize your own inadequacy, and then from that, And we're talking about in the abstract. We'll see it in action later on. Hopefully it'll give some content to this bare form that we're laying out.
Well, but I think we can give some everyday examples. You know, I tried to give ones from aesthetics last time. I won't repeat that. But just think about, you start as a kid believing that people are good. People basically tell the truth. And then somebody comes along and really disappoints you, just lies to you, hurts you. And then you might just, oh, everybody sucks. But then you kind of get over that and you realize, okay, well, no, people are basically good, but they have flaws. Or you gain, it's not even just some people are good and some people are bad. You gain some insight into why people lie in particular situations. So the synthesis, the speculative, the positively rational, it's still sort of a use of the understanding, you might say, but it's more developed.
Right. I just wanted to ask you what you meant by use of the understanding, because it's not...
Yeah, the rational, I think, might be different than the... It'll be its own faculty.
I was using the understanding as just picking out patterns in the world. But if we say that the way that he's set up the understanding is immediate, in other words, like, I look at dog and I say dog. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to reason it. It's that I come to this. But again, these things are relative.
The rational is actually the intuitive here. It is rational intuition. That is the speculative step. You now have something concrete in what was abstract, right? Hence, in part two above, although it is something thought and something abstract, it is at the same time something concrete, because it is not simple formal unity, but a unity of distinct determinations.
But just in terms of the understanding and its connection to immediacy, it seems like that reason is where the mediate, where something is mediated. And it's just, you could see then how it's a sliding scale, that before you knew what a dog was, you might have some sort of immediate reaction to a fluffy thing or whatever, and then you gain some wrong-headed notion of what kind of thing that is, and then, well, you see a cat, and that blows your mind, and like it... But then the synthesis of that is dog. So dog was a product of some initial reasoning process, but then it becomes the immediate way that you identify this thing going forward. In the same way that this complexity of people's goodness or badness, that then becomes your new way of understanding immediately the world after you've gone through this period of transitioning to this more sophisticated way of thinking. Still the understanding, if it's an immediate...
What's still the understanding? The speculative moment? I think he wants to mark off the rational from the understanding.
Okay, so the rational is how you get to the new conceptual scheme.
Right.
The understanding is what you use day to day, minute to minute, in pattern recognition. So the example I gave before, a variation of what he said about seeing the goodness of God in things, about seeing the banana, you know, that is an argument that people explicitly make. They're using reason. But once you get that, and this was Plantinga's point a few episodes back, then that becomes sort of the immediate default way that you apply the faculty of the understanding to make sense of the world around you. As you look there, oh, look, there's a flower. It's the goodness of God. And Hegel's actually recommending this as a perfectly legitimate way.
I think the rational is, you know, we have spatiotemporal intuition. The rational is intuitive, and it's analogous in that sense. It intuits, you know, where understanding grasps things discursively through universals, reason can intuit its objects, and it can know things, for instance, like God, as he points out in the addition. So we know about the rational above all because we know God, we know about God, and we know him as the one who is utterly self-determined. And that's part of the other point here, is that through the rational, we can have knowledge of things which are self-determined in the sense what they are is not dependent on their relation to other things, right? Which is, we'll see some of how this works coming up. They are these self-subsisting entities, and they can't be known through those relations. God can't be known as the sum of all perfect predicates, for instance, but has to be known as a whole. And reason is what will help us do that. That's the speculative moment.
Right. Immediacy as a word is really important here. It's a sort of blueprint for how there's this jagged path to absolute knowing where, hey, you think you got somewhere by realizing mediation, making your concept clearer, but then you grasp immediately again, and then you realize, negate that, mediate again, and so on and so on and so forth. This three-part structure is basically the roadmap for the rest of the logic. It'll happen again and again and again. Doesn't make it that much easier to understand and piece apart, but it's certainly a big help.
So one other thing here, just trying to get at with this, what he means by speculation, again, reading on 132, the term speculation tends to be used in ordinary life in a very vague and at the same time secondary sense, as for instance, when people talk about a matrimonial or commercial speculation, which is funny, like speculating on the market or speculating on the right mate. all that is taken to mean here is that, on the one hand, what is immediately present must be transcended, and on the other, that whatever the content of these speculations may be, although it is initially only something subjective, it ought not to remain so, but is to be realized or translated into objectivity. So initially something subjective, that means initially in the something in the thoughts and mind of a particular person, right? So that's content, the way we think of it in the Kantian sense as part of someone's experience. But he's worried here about the idea that we get at something that's not merely subjective, and that speculation gets us that. We get contents which are not in any subjective in the sense of in any particular person's head. We get the things in themselves through this.
Right. By demonstrating how our conceptual systems are finite, we also demonstrate that, no, it's not just a single mind thinking, capturing the world in its head in a certain way. You also demonstrate that there's something outside a conceptual system that it's reacting to and trying to grasp.
The other thing here is that the sort of skeptical antitheses, right, between being and reality, which seem to sever the subject from the object, they are incorporated into the objective. They become the ingredients of the objective. So farther down on 132, the speculative is neither provisionally nor in the end itself something merely subjective. Instead, it expressly contains the very antitheses at which the understanding stops short, including, therefore, that of the subjective and objective too, sublated within itself. And precisely for this reason, it proves to be concrete and a totality. So what he's trying to say here is that these antitheses, which we normally think of showing that things are not as they seem, are actually these two poles that give us the content of things themselves. So they are both in that content. They don't sever the subject from the object. They are actually objective tensions. They're not tensions between us and the world that we can't know. They're objective tensions in the things themselves.
Right.
And that's where their concreteness comes from, actually.
Can we try to give an example here? Because I don't want to just give the example of being that we're going to get to in the second half of this discussion. But so, when speculation grasps it, it doesn't just grasp it as it is in itself, but it grasps it in sort of the contradictions that are buried within it. So the implicit, the going beyond the thing. So say the understanding has no problem helping you pick out a light source. This is light. But then when you think more about it, and you might think, oh, light is good. Light is wonderful. I just wish there was only light. You might naively think that, but then somebody will jump up and point out to you, how would you even know what light is unless you knew what darkness is? And the speculation would come along and say, well, actually, the light contains darkness as its opposition right there. When I'm grasping the concept light, the only way that I can grasp that is to know that it means, among other things, not dark. Is that correct? Is that what the speculation is doing? Is it transcending light to its opposite as well?
Except those are sublated. Those become moments, and those are no longer exactly as you described.
I can't quite think of the third term, what light, dark, and mildly lit, I suppose.
First of all, we need a mediating term. And then light and dark have to get sublated. They have to get sort of dissolved into the soup of the unifying term.
Well, it might just be that you gain a more sophisticated understanding of how vision works and how the physics of light works. And so it's not like there's just these forces of light and darkness in the world, but there's light waves that travel around and you could be in the way of them and catch some of them with your eyes and you could not. Like, that's a whole point of view that does sublate light and darkness, that those are no longer primal elemental forces that a child might think of them as.
Yeah, the speculative is of metaphysical objects, right? Even if we come up with these examples where we're not talking about metaphysics. The rational and the speculative are directed towards things like God and soul and cosmos. And
you know, I thought that Mark's example was good in this respect. And even when you say metaphysical objects, Wes, in that Mark's example, light is a kind of thing. And what you're trying to sort out there is, what kind of thing is it? And the speculative activity would be going down that road, right? I mean, like, what about an atom? Like, we start thinking about what is the world made of, and you go down the road of breaking it down into elements, and there are atoms or not atoms.
Yeah, he does talk about atomism, but metaphysical atomism, which is distinct from scientific atomism.
Why? Why is that distinct at all? I mean, that concept of an atom would be the same kind of thing.
Because metaphysical atomism is the idea of these partless points at the bottom of things, which are metaphysical entities and perhaps have souls. And in the end, he identifies the speculative with the mystical.
Let's read to that.
On 133, it should be mentioned here that the meaning of the speculative is also to be understood as being the same as what was used in earlier times to be called mystical, especially with regard to the religious consciousness and its content. And then he goes on to say, the way we speak of it nowadays is the mystical applies to what is mysterious and incomprehensible. And that's not what he's talking about. So, you know, we must remark first that the mystical is certainly something mysterious, but only for the understanding, and then only because abstracted entity is the principle of the understanding. But when it is regarded as synonymous with the speculative, the mystical is the concrete unity of just those determinations that count as true for the understanding only in their separation and opposition. So the understanding can only grasp things in their separation and opposition, and the speculative combines them. I think what he's suggesting here ultimately is that we can know God. We can have knowledge of God, as opposed to what Kant was saying. We can actually, through this speculative moment, know God and other metaphysical entities.
I'm going to take Dylan and Wes and sublate them by saying that what Dylan was saying is right, and what Mark was saying is right with respect to concepts of light and dark. He has a philosophy of nature, which is part two of the three-part encyclopedia, of which what we're reading is part one, where he does something very much like that, and he does something like that with ethical life. But Wes is right for the logic, where what he's doing now is very much showing the interconnections between things like being, becoming, nothing, these metaphysical concepts. But he extends this to other things as well, like ethical life and so on. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Well, he says, not too far down here, that the dialectic, as we described it, is the motivating force in everything. So you jump to an idea like, okay, well, what about biological life? Is it really that the father is the thesis and the mother says, you ain't all that? And somehow then the child, it seems like he would have to use or want to use, and I'm putting words in his mouth. Maybe Amog can tell me from his other reading of Hegel whether he does get this silly, but does he think that the offspring somehow is the sublating of the parents?
I don't think so. There's sort of silly stuff in Hegel that uncharitable Hegel readers have pulled out off the kind of thing that you're talking about.
Is Hegel post-Darwin?
No, 1817.
What about earlier pre-Darwinian forms of evolution, where they might have thought that, yes, there's evolution, but it's not survival of the fittest, it's a gradual progression toward perfection. Like, that seems exactly the kind of thing that Hegel would be picking up on.
There was Lamarck. I don't know how much Hegel read him, yeah.
Yes, when is Lamarck compared to this?
I think in the late 18th century, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, from Lamarck is, you know, the... I think it's the whole giraffes get long necks because they're stretching for the food and then that gets genetically transferred. Is that right? You can have traits that you developed.
But Lamarck wouldn't have called it genetically, right? But the idea would be that giraffes, generation from generation, get long necks.
Well, he understood there were inherited properties. Yeah, he wouldn't call it genetic specifically.
Right. So Lamarck is 1744 to 1829. So there you go. Yeah.
But anyway, you know, I think, yeah, Mark, as you brought up, the dialectic is manifested everywhere. We skipped that at the end of 81, where he says, as becoming, everything around us is a manifestation of dialectic. And then he calls dialectic God's might, as opposed to, you know, we're understanding, we call that God's goodness. Dialectic is God's might. It's interesting, this idea that becoming, what we think of as change and generation and decay and all of that, there's a logical underpinning to that. That's a kind of amazing idea, this idea that, you know, the underlying logic of the world is the grounding for that.
And that's the way in which it can't be that there's this distinction between metaphysical categories and other kinds of ways of thinking, because this part here is like, this is the way thinking happens. And so all the ways in which we break up the world are going to come down to these distinctions that he's making here. And even if there's a way of applying it in some respect to ethics or to science or something, they're all going to trace directly back to this kind of thing.
Well, all the legitimate kinds of thinking. Again, a lot of what people consider thinking is just bring in something completely external to the matter at hand and sort of judge it that way. That's not legitimate thinking. Thinking is really focusing on the topic at hand and seeing and analyzing it, the contradictions within it.
And that's what ties it back to and makes it seem like, well, this actually is about logic, right? Because you would...
About normative logic, yeah.
Yeah. There's this... In the middle of 82, it says, the logic of mere understanding is involved in speculative logic, and can at will be elicited from it by the simple process of omitting the dialectical and reasonable element. When that is done, it becomes what the common logic is, a descriptive collection of sundry thought forms and rules, which, finite though they are taken to be something infinite. So when I read that, and I think it's consistent with especially the first sentence with what we've been talking about, that the understanding lies within speculative logic. It did make me think that somehow you could derive common logic out of Hegel's logic.
Yes, explicitly so. It is one of the things that he discusses later. And when he means by common logic, it's Aristotelian logic.
Yes, sir, yeah.
But I've, you know, some of the secondary stuff I was reading was, no, you actually could apply this. Don't just say, oh, well, that's because Aristotelian logic was backwards and Frege and Russell or folks like that over. No, whatever kind of system of straight up logic you have, it would still be slotted into that space in Hegel's system. It is about forms and not content.
Yeah, and so in this way, it just made me think of other expansions that would be expansions of thought, like quantum mechanics. One exercise that you would say that to show that you actually really understood what was going on is you say, okay, if quantum mechanics really is an expansion of the sphere of applicability of something like Newtonian mechanics, then I should be able to simplify quantum mechanics under the correct set of simplifying assumptions. It will become Newtonian mechanics. And there was a lot of effort put into that, saying that that's exactly what happens. In the limiting case, when things get big enough, that quantum mechanics really just turns into Newtonian mechanics.
It's been sublated. Well, that is a great way to wrap up the first half of our discussion. And in the second half of the discussion, we're going to actually get to being and becoming and quantity and quality and determinate being there. So folks should check in next week for that, for the final part, the week after it comes out, March 21st, the second half will come out, and the Hegel after show recording will be on March 27th. Don't miss that. If you don't want to wait for next week to get the second half, just go become Partial Exam Life Citizen. You can get it right now. You don't have to wait at all. You don't have to hear any more commercials. Your experience here will be sublated into a superior. All right.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.